This is The Topic is Trek, episode 34 for Friday, December 14th, 2018. With a little kelp from my friends. Welcome to The Topic is Trek, the podcast that runs on impulse power. Join us for a journey where no show has gone before. If it has to do with Star Trek, there's a good chance we'll talk about it. Sooner or later, because on this show, the topic is Trek. Engage already! I always feel like we should have a better show based on that music. So we have to try harder. Yeah, we have to try harder.
like Star Trek V?
Exactly. Well, yes.
Harder.
Yeah,
try much harder
than that. Well, hello, everyone. I'm Clinton Allward, one of your Topic is Trek co-hosts, and beaming in to join me, as you've already heard, as always, is Mr. Craig Stepp.
Hey, this ship smells funny.
And, well... it's space. Get some space Febreze. I don't know. And
Craig, it's that new ship smell. Don't you recognize it?
Oh, is that what it is?
Smells like space. And although space does have a smell, but that's a topic for another time.
Burnt steak.
And also joining us, I would say as always, except he's been absent a fair amount recently.
Some of us have day jobs still.
Mr. Chuck Tomasi.
This is how this show is starting out so far.
We had the theme music and it was downhill from there.
Yeah. Right. Good to be here again.
Excellent, excellent. So the holidays are barreling down upon us. I'm sure everybody's got all their shopping done.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm with you, Clinton. That's what it says here in the show notes.
That 2-day delivery with no shipping is...
Well, you guys had a long list of gift ideas last time.
We did. I'm hoping that a lot of people took advantage of that. If you haven't had a chance to look at that list, please go back and look at the show notes for episode 33 over at thetopicistrek.com.
You know, we should have hooked up an Amazon affiliates link through those if we were smart.
I know.
Millions of people listening to this show are now clicking.
Give us about 5 minutes, then go hit the show notes.
That's right. Hang on a second. Yeah. All right. But we have lots to cover this episode. We're going to be covering news. We're going to be covering a new episode of Trek Shorts or Short Treks or Treks Wearing Shorts. And we'll have our Warp Speed Roundtable. Let's get things started. Kicked off right now with a story coming to us via Craig.
Hey there.
Oh, ow, ooh, ow, ooh.
Ow.
Oh, wait, you didn't say the magic words. What section of the show are we in?
Why, we're in subspace chatter.
You don't need all that subspace chatter.
There we go.
We do, Charlie. We do. I keep telling you, we do.
I miss an episode and the format goes to hell.
Please help us out, Craig.
So, actually, I think John Cho is going to help us out because he remains optimistic about Star Trek IV.
And that reboot.
Voyage Home. No, not that IV.
No.
So, just as Star Trek IV seemed poised to get off the ground, it came to a crashing halt. But one member of the Enterprise crew sees a bright future ahead for the film series. John Cho, who plays Hikaru Sulu, in the Kelvin timeline, Star Trek films.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. He's gay, by the way. his character is. While he doesn't have any new news to share about Star Trek IV, he remains optimistic that he and his co-stars will make at least one more Trek movie. Sadly, I don't have any news for you. I wish I more for you.
I sadly don't have any news for you. I wish I more for you there, though.
I wish I had more for you there.
Yeah, I think this was a typo in the story. Yeah. I think John actually spoke correct.
Thank you, comicbook.com.
I wish I more you. So I wish I had more for you, though. John Cho says, tells Playlist, the website. I don't know what the ins and outs are of the studio are, but I'm optimistic that there will be another one because I'm optimistic about Star Trek, says, and it's in its place in culture, and I think it will come back around. I think it's an important part of American popular culture. Okay. Has he been reading the books or something? He's just now familiar with Star Trek.
He is.
I think it's an important part of American culture that speaks to America's best impulses, and I think that there will also be a place, there will always be a place for Star Trek films. I just hope it will hope to be in it, and there isn't another total different group of people. Me too. I'm kind of happy with what we got so far.
That's right.
I'm bullish about it, and honestly, for personal reasons, I suppose the last film has a cloud over it. Speaking of Anton Yelchin, after the last one, and for me, it would be an important personally to make at least one to make one more release. Who wrote this?
I don't know, but John is shaking his head, going, "This is not what I said. I didn't say these words."
He says, "I think it would alleviate that part a bit for us, at least make one more." So Star Trek 4 is expected to be a father and son time travel tale, like a road trip.
Well, the cat's in the cradle and
involving.
My brain is going to go there and write that whole song.
Okay, well, we don't want to get takedown, so we're not going to sing.
I got a 2-hour plane ride tomorrow. It could happen.
Where's the song masher? Involving Chris Pine's Captain Kirk meeting his dead father.
Well, that's easy to meet your dead father. To have them alive is the hard part.
Well, if he's dead, he didn't have to chase him very much,
I suppose.
So Chris Hemsworth, George Kirk, but both stars dropped out of the project after contract negotiations stalled. I still feel like it's a tactic, but we'll see. Recasting George would be relatively simple. Hemsworth is a big star, but he was only in the opening prologue of Star Trek. Recasting Captain Kirk would be a significantly larger challenge.
Yeah, I agree that if you recast George Kirk, I mean,
it could happen. Yeah.
Yeah. People know that it was Hemsworth, but I don't think that would be too difficult to work around.
Hey, well, there is another Hemsworth brother.
There are. There's like 400 of them. So, you know, just. Oh, Chris, you don't want to do it.
300, they're all part of
that. Liam, do you want it? No? Okay, you know what? Okay, we'll just keep going down the line here, and, you know, we'll get what it's like.
Bob Hemsworth?
Dwight Schultz, anybody?
Schultz. He wants to be in the Picard series.
Yeah, this just in.
All right, well, we're going to go from Hollywood all the way across the country for our next story.
To Ticonderoga, New York, from WCAX. Excited fans flocked to Ticonderoga, New York Saturday to meet the William Shatner, Captain Kirk, the original Star Trek Channel 3 reporter and Star Trek fan. Cat, never mind. Cat.
I thought your Skype was breaking up. It was just you.
Villanzoni was there too. All of the all the Star Trek fans here at Ticonderoga set. You only find one quite like Julian Myers, and this 6-year-old knows exactly who he's here to see. Who's your favorite character? Huh? Captain Kirk, answers Julian. Just like that. That's what he sounds like.
Does he really? That's a great impression.
And Captain Kirk was here to meet him and hundreds of other fans. This is the 87-year-old actor's second visit to the set. He says he was astounded by how realistic it is. Or how badly he remembers it. You know, he's getting older. He could have memory problems. He looks just like my home in Iowa.
I'm waiting for Gene to walk around the corner any moment now.
There he is now. Wait a second.
Hold on. D, is that you?
Oh, dear me.
Too soon?
Yeah, too soon.
These sets were made to order. They're done exactly the way the sets were made. In fact, they're coming apart in exactly the same way as our sets came apart, said Shatner.
Yeah, I'm sure James Colley's going, that. Great. Thanks, Bill. Stop tearing the sets apart. You chew the scenery on your show, not on my set.
James Colley is the man behind the vision of the set. You're building this thing from scratch. Why?
Why?
Well, it was a childhood love. I used to turn that TV on, in fact. We watched it on WCAX at 11 o'clock at night, says James Colley.
There's a plug for the station right there.
Here. We'll help you out.
Yeah. But this is like the ultimate in prop building.
Oh, yeah. And some of the pieces, the components they made back then aren't available now. So it's like, where do you get that Christmas wrapping paper in the corridors?
Mm. Well, when I took the set tour, they described where they got some of the stuff from. One of the things, though, that they did, when you have the divider between two of the rooms in the crew's quarters, there are these like circular pieces that make up a semi-transparent wall. Mm-hmm. So it's a room divided, not a solid wall. Mm-hmm. Well, they couldn't get that. So what they did at the time was they cut they sliced the tops of bottles and glued just an eighth of an inch from the top of a plastic bottle and mm-hmm. glued those together to make that thing. Now they've got, well, we've 3D printed now, you know,
right.
But I'm saying that that's what they did on the recreation set to create that look that they had for something that they couldn't get anymore. But the set they have the same bedspreads in the medical bay, that kind of red shimmery fabric.
Yeah.
Beds and everything. And we still, the three of us, you know, I got to get back there and you guys got to come with me. We still got to get back to, got to get there. And
I do want to see it. Is it still going to be there?
Oh, it's going to be there because now it's officially sanctioned by CBS. So they do tours as a thing. So that's why they're having these conventions and stuff to also promote it. But I mean, they're also trying to, we've discussed on the show before, they're doing things like having week long sessions where you come in, you write a story,
mm-hmm.
produce it, you know, and you have people there that are helping you do that stuff. So they're coming up with all these different ways of working the set to make sure that it stays a going interest.
Mm-hmm. They did it. They do have a closing quote in here. He says, "What's your favorite Captain Kirk moment?" To which Julian replied, "That's a recorded quote from Julian. 6-year-old does great impressions.
He does a better impression of Kirk than you do of Julian. So go figure that one out. We also have a link to the video. If you go to check the show notes for episode 34 over at thetopicistrek.com, the video that they actually ran on this news for this TV station is there. And the woman who's she's wearing a full Discovery uniform. And I don't think it's something she bought for the story. I think it's something she had already.
Oh, I was going to say that. I thought the news crew at the office, oh, here, just wear this. It'd be cool.
No, it seemed to fit her really well. I think that's hers.
I don't know anything about Star Trek. Here, just put this on. It's something to do with Star Trek, I'm sure.
They'll love you.
They will.
It looks like a bathrobe.
All right. Well, speaking of Discovery, I'll do another story from comicbook.com and hope that John Chodas quotes at this one.
Let's hope the editing's better.
Yes, indeed. This also has to do, though, with Ticonderoga because, let me see if this Star Trek Discovery is going to be sticking around a little longer than expected when it returns for its second season. Today, the Star Trek, the original series set tour in Ticonderoga, New York, is hosting the Christmas with the Captains event, featuring Star Trek, the original series star William Shatner and Anson Mount, who plays Captain Christopher Pike in Star Trek Discovery Season 2. So this is that same event that we were just talking about. According to Trek Corps, Mount announced that CBS All Access had extended the episode order for Discovery's second season to add an additional episode. That means the new season, they missed the word there. That means the new season will now consist of 14 episodes instead of the original order for 13. So
I'm sorry, I was out of sync with the audience.
we get one more there, but that's interesting as well, because I wanted to mention the story for two things. One, that apparently we're getting one more episode, but also that other story talked about William Shatner being at the set in Ticonderoga. Well, Anson Mount was there as well, and was billed as Christmas with the Captains. So you could see both of them there.
I saw him in the video, and I was like, but I didn't see him mentioned in the article.
Yeah. So we want to give a props to Anson. I mean, I don't know if either of you follow his Twitter account, but he tweets all sorts of bizarre stuff from the set of Discovery. I mean,
I hadn't even thought to look at his Twitter account.
Okay. You know, the other day it was, here's what we had for lunch from craft services.
It's a pile of gawk. Entire
meal, you know.
It's a pile of gawk.
No, it actually looked rather tasty. But he clearly a fan, clearly having the time of his life doing this role. So I can't wait to see his Christopher Pike when Discovery actually premieres, and it's coming up very soon now. Oh, can't wait! But
we got a tech short coming up, and then the series.
You think give us a preview on the cruise?
I was wondering the same thing, because we're about a week out.
Yeah, I'm thinking they will. I think we're going to get a pre-screening.
Why don't we'll just ask Mary Chifo to bring something with her. Could you just get a copy, put it in a
at Mary the Chief. When should we be by your room to see the screening?
That's right.
Hey, by the way, I see, speaking of Anson Mount up at the Ticonderoga, he's sitting in the captain's chair, the original one, the TOS one, and he's reaching under the front, between your legs, in a chair. He says, "The hell was he doing here? There's no seat adjustment in this thingy."
So he wasn't looking for the inflatable life vest,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, we talked about the fact we have another short trek coming up. We have Discovery coming up, but there's another trek thing that's happening fairly soon, and we'll hear a bit more about that production.
Oh, is that my cue?
That is for you, Craig.
Okay.
So tell us a bit about that other Trek thing that's going on.
Oh, the other white meat Star Trek.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh my, Craig. There's no intelligent life here.
Yeah, you got that right. So Alex Kurtzman, who is the overseer, the overlord of the expanding CBS. I welcome our Star Trek overlord.
Move on.
Of the expanding CBS Trek on TV franchise they say TV, but is it really? Spoke with Entertainment Weekly about the still unentitled Picard series.
We should give it a title. We should name it. I don't know.
TV card. No, I don't know. Picard. I don't know. I'll think of something good.
Picard.
Star Trek.
Beyond.
The next generation. Star Trek.
Discover.
Silver.
Discovery Picard. All right. So anyway, Alex Kurtzman did reveal some key details. In the past, the producers behind the expanding Star Trek universe have told us that each of the shows will have its own voice and tonal vision. In a new interview with EW, Alex Kurtzman gets into more detail about what that means for the Picard show in particular. I think they just call it the Picard show.
Yeah. And they have a desk, and he brings out guests.
Picard, up all night. Yeah, that's it.
Alex says, it is extremely different rhythm than Discovery. Discovery is a bullet. Picard is a very contemplative show, and it will find a balance between the speed of Discovery and the nature of what Next Gen was. But I believe it will have its own rhythm. EW also quotes Kurtzman giving a bit more detail in contrasting the new Picard show with the second season of Discovery, saying it's more grounded. It's not the right way to more grounded is not the right way to put it, because season two of Discovery is also grounded.
Yeah. You're grounded.
You're in space. Two. Yeah, there's no ground in space. It will feel more real world, ? He says. If that's the right way to put it. Well, we don't know. You're the one talking about it. Why are you asking us?
Yeah, well, it does that does give one pause to think, what does that mean? Is that I'm wondering if it's dealing more with just Picard contemplating existence or something. I mean, I'm not quite sure how grounded in that sense means.
It's way too early. We have no details to try, and it's too cryptic. I don't get it. Who knows? If it's more, it will feel more real world. Maybe he's not going to be so much in space. I don't know.
He's just going to be in the vineyard walking around.
Yeah, he's going to the convenience store, picking up some bread.
That's real world, all right.
Yeah.
Let's see what's on Netflix.
He's married and his wife's yelling at him all the time.
And every day at 3 p.m.
My goodness, look at the time.
Back to the other show, Sir Patrick. No, the back over there. Just go back.
He's got to get to the early bird special buffet.
Oh, I thought you meant the loo. Every day, 3 o'clock, like clockwork. My goodness, look at the time.
It's the early bird special at the Sizzler.
Yeah.
Oh, it's that space brand. Oh, yes. Anyway.
Yeah. Alex also did say that the writer's room has broken out about 8 episodes, and they're moving quickly. So there's a lot to get excited about. And apparently the series goes into production in April, and we should be seeing it towards the end of 2019.
Right. That was an interesting bit that came out as well, that we will see it by the end of the year. So in theory, next year we'll get all of season two of Discovery. We'll probably get, I believe, Short Treks is now an ongoing thing as well. So we'll get some more Short Treks and we'll get the Picard series next year.
Now, one other bit of detail that he was talking about the show, that he said, without revealing too much about it, people have so many questions about Picard and what happened to him. And the idea, we get to take time to answer these questions in the wake of many, many things he's had to deal with in Next Gen is really exciting. So I imagine losing Data. I have a feeling, how can B4 not be part of that?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. The problem with having B4 in it. Now, it's an android. So does an android age? Would you have the android show signs of age because it's a skin on the android?
They did say that they could explain away age by saying that it was designed to age over time.
So, I mean, if he's had to, in essence, take B4 in and teach him about life, right? That B4 is kind of like an open slate.
Maybe at this time, and maybe at this point, maybe he's, advanced enough where he's doing his own thing now, and he's not necessarily on the show all the time. I don't know.
Right.
I would like to see
we're not claiming that Brent Spiner has said that he's in it. We're not claiming anybody's. We claim that everybody and their brother has said that, I'd be really interested in being in it, but, we don't know.
I will claim Patrick Stewart's going to be in it.
Oh, that's going out on a limb, sir. I'm going to hold you to that.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So our next story is a little bit more nuts and bolts about this new Picard series.
You said nuts.
You said bolts.
Oh my goodness! This show really has gone after. Remember when the theme song played and it was really awesome?
That was an awesome theme song. We should play it at the end.
We should at the top of the hill.
But we play something else at the end, so never mind.
All right. From MercuryNews.com, Star Trek beams down to California thanks to TV tax credits. That's right. It's all about the money. It's all about the money. California is winning the space race when it comes to science fiction TV series, that is. The latest round of shows to qualify for the state's production tax credit program includes the new Star Trek series as yet untitled Next Generation. We're calling
it the Picard Show.
Next Generation Silver. Follow-up starring that program and subsequent movies Enterprise, Captain Picard. CBS All Access, other show from the franchise, Star Trek Discovery, is based in Toronto, primarily due to Canada's own lucrative production incentives. Among returning shows with sci-fi theme that are taking advantage of the tax credit again are Season 3 of Seth MacFarlane's Trek satire, The Orville, and Season 2 of Strange Angel, about a 1940s rocket scientist who gets involved with an occultist. The other new series to qualify for California incentives are Why Women Kill, from Desperate Housewives creator Mark Cherry, and something from HBO called Flowers of Helvetica. Has nothing, probably something nothing to do with the font.
You're a font of information about that whole thing.
The nine shows chosen this month are expected to employ 2,140 crew members, 1,820 actors, and 25,000 man days worth of extra and stand-ins. In all, six recurring and three new projects for which this rounds $90 million of California's $330 million annual production tax credits are reserved, should generate about $456 million, that's a lot of big bucks, in qualified expenditures to the state's below-the-line workers and vendors.
So that's interesting. Well, two things I find interesting there are the number of actors we're talking about for these.
Yeah, no kidding.
Nine shows, 1,820.
We've got a lot of people to kill off.
So that's just the Picard Show by itself.
Those are the people interested in being in the Picard Show.
You want to be on the Picard Show. The second thing is the amount of. So we talk about that they have an allotment of $330 million total, and they've allotted essentially a third of it to these nine shows, which is weird. I mean, that just seems like a very large amount of your total budget that you can use for these credits for a very small amount of shows.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, well, the other thing I want to mention was, and here's an even weirder thing that's not in this version of the article, because they had several different articles that talked about the same subject, that the show that gets the largest amount of the credits is The Orville, and I think that's $15.8 million, but the Picard series is second at $15.6 million.
It's a close tie, now, a close second.
Well, what I'm finding interesting with that is that we don't know how many episodes there are of the Picard series.
Right.
Right. So is that an indication that it's essentially the same number of episodes as The Orville is going to be, because your amount of money you're allocating is about the same?
Hmm. Interesting speculation. Question,
huh? Well, they've got, what did we say? They already cracked eight episodes already.
Right.
Isn't that what I said?
Yes. But there's no indication that they have X number more to do after that. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have a count on how many episodes it is. So at least we're looking forward to eight, but possibly we might be looking at upwards of 15 to 20 episodes of the Picard, the unnamed Picard series, the Picard Show, Picard Silver.
Send us your vote.
Yes. Send us your idea for a name for the Picard series.
Hey, by the way, I thought it was weird. I know that the states did tax credits and stuff like this, but I've seen this write-up about all these tax credits in several places, specifically about the Orville, and then also, of course, Star Trek and stuff too, but it was like, I just thought it was weird that they were promoting, or these articles were coming out talking about all these tax credits. I don't remember, maybe I just didn't read them before, but I didn't remember seeing so much write up about them.
I mean, I'm seeing this one, obviously, because I'm searching for Star Trek stories, but a lot of states have that. Here in Massachusetts, we have the same type of thing, tax credits for stuff, and we have productions that come through here all the time.
Georgia.
Because of it.
Yeah.
Right. Georgia has a lot of stuff as well. So, and I'm assuming Arizona must have a fair amount of production there as well. So
I just thought it was weird that I saw this not necessarily from Mercury News, but I saw a bunch of different places talking about the tax credit. I'm like, wow, is that really a lot of new? I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's employment in addition to everything else.
Right.
I mean, we talked about that number of people that were in that article. It's like, you know, like 4,000 people.
Right.
Total.
Okay.
All right. So let's move on to. Oh,
is that how many people are interested in Picard now? Well, it's gone up.
No, that's how many people want to be on the show. That's the first episode. It's just going to be a crawling list of people. Here are people that were interested in being on my show. And it just
crawls.
Pew, pew, pew. They all die in the opening scene massacre, like Battlestar Galactica.
It's like 10 minutes of content. And then the rest, other 40 minutes is credits.
I'm on the list. Right. I want to be on the list. Yeah, I'd be interested.
Put me on there.
Yep.
Hey, he's my announcer. I think that I've got the in to have a shot at being on the show. All righty then.
Right.
Let's move on to the writers of the new Star Trek short. Explain how it fits into Trek canon.
Yeah.
The latest installment of Short Treks will answer answered a big question. The Star Trek Discovery fans won't even know they had. How did Mr. Saru come to join Starfleet? Unlike the self-contained two previous short treks, Runaway and Calypso, The Brightest Star adds a huge new piece to the ever-expanding canon puzzle of Star Trek. And because the ending of the short features an appearance of a beloved Star Trek officer, and we'll say spoiler alerts here because we will be talking about the Brightest Star as our main mission.
So, spoiler alert.
Very good. Thank you. Fans might wonder when this all happens. So in other words, when does the incidence of the Brightest Star take place? Now, because I don't want to do too much spoilery stuff ahead of time, I'm just going to do the piece of math that says the incidence of the Brightest Star take place 8 years before the flashback incident on Discovery that shows Burnham coming onto the Shinzu.
Oh, yeah. When she first beams in with Sarek and hangs out for a minute.
Exactly. So that means this episode takes place 18 years before Discovery.
Wait, did you say 8 or 18?
Well, 8 years prior to the flashback.
Okay.
And then,
gotcha.
So then you
Burnham,
add 10 years
Burnham
on top of that.
Burnham was on Discovery for 10 years?
Well, that other person who comes down, well, we already done spoiler alert, so might as well. So Giorgio comes down to the planet on a Shinzu shuttle.
Right.
So that means she's been on the Shinzu for 18 years.
Well, she was a lieutenant at that age in that clip too.
But between all that time, unless she transferred off and came back again, and we don't know, that clearly was not her first day on the ship. So has she been on that same ship for 20 years or so?
That's a long run.
You know,
I think I get tired of being on the same ship for 20 years.
Talk about Riker not wanting to, you know, move up. And
I'll skip this promotion. I'm happy right here.
So I thought that was interesting that they place it in this way. And we'll talk more about the Brightest Star. But I'm thinking about the post-Brightest Star thing, saying, okay, that's 8 years. So in 8 years, you have someone from a pre-warp culture come into
Starfleet,
the Federation,
yep,
get acclimated to the fact that there are other worlds out there.
Go through officer training.
Go through Starfleet, get off the training, and get assigned a command position in 8 years.
Maybe he's really good.
Kirk did it in 3.
Yeah, well.
He cheated.
He did. Well, maybe Saru cheated then. No. Could be. I don't know.
Well, they didn't teach Saru warp theory in grade school like everybody else. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's learning. I mean, think about how much he doesn't know.
Right.
So the fact that he's now joining this larger universe, there's a lot to absorb there before you even think about going into Starfleet.
Mm-hmm.
So
wait a minute, are we talking about the episode now?
No, we're talking about afterward, right? We're talking about after after those events take place. Like, so now he's off of the planet and he's got 8 years. And again, it's probably not his first day as a bridge officer
yeah.
when Burnham comes onto the bridge. So how, you know, there's still quite like, did he do all this in like 7 years?
See, I had the same kind of thought as soon as I saw it. I went, oh, that's kind of cool. And then I started thinking, you know, he sure did come up to speed. She did mention that he was gifted, you know, and stuff like that, because he was able to reuse their technology and reverse it. And I was like, but still, there's a lot. I mean, he lives in a pre-warp society and they're giving themselves up freely for whatever god, and you know, they don't look interested in any technology. His dad wanted him to get rid of it.
Right. So we'll talk about some of that aspect.
Okay.
We talk about the episode.
Yeah. So yes. Anyway, yeah, you're right though. I remember thinking, wow, he must be really smart. He was really gifted, because I can't imagine trying to learn all that stuff.
Yeah, that's one smart hors d'oeuvre. Okay.
No.
Anyway, let's move on from there. But speaking of hors d'oeuvres, wow. But
you won smart sushi.
Yes, I put this story in because it shows that the Roddenberry Foundation is kind of trying to live that dream. So, could you tell us a bit about this, Craig?
Sure. So, the Star Trek Foundation grants vegan startup $250,000 for converting 1.6 million. Into plant-based diets. What, did they just mash up the money?
No.
Keep reading. Read the opening paragraph.
Read on, McDuff.
All right. So the Roddenberry Foundation, inspired by the late Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry, awarded $250,000 to a vegan startup, Green Monday, for converting 1.6 million Hong Kong residents to a plant-based diet. Oh, see, that makes more sense than the title.
Yes.
The Roddenberry Foundation launched in 2010 to drive social change. This year's Roddenberry Prize, funded by the Roddenberry Estate, that's a lot of Roddenberries in there.
It is indeed.
Spotlighted how female education, women's rights, reducing food waste, and consuming less meat are vital to combat climate change. Lior Ip, CEO of the foundation, explained to Fast Company, "The motivation is to let the world know that there are other ways of thinking about climate change." Leading Asian vegan campaign and social venture group on Green Monday was one recipient, founded by Hong Kong entrepreneur David Yang, the maker of vegan pork product OmniPork. Okay, I'm down with the name.
Favorites of the queue, I guess.
Yeah. Usually when I think of OmniPork, I'm thinking I want my bacon here, I want my barbecue here. Anyway, so and owner of the vegan-friendly market and cafe, which is totally against, my comment was totally against what they're talking about going for here. Friendly market cafe chain Green Common, Green Monday invites the Asian community to give plant-based meals a try, comparable to the Meatless Monday. I'm sorry, Green Monday, Meatless Monday, Green Common. Meatless Monday campaign, popular throughout the U.S. and Europe. Its efforts include partnering with Live Kindly to expand its media reach and collaborating with Chinese University of Hong Kong's Lee Wu Sing College. After a credit-bearing Future of Food plant-based living course, so the organization is honored to receive the Roddenberry Prize, announcing via Instagram that with the award, it will continue the effort to impact and scale, drive positive and social change, and improve the lives of people through plant-based diets.
So we've had stories before about the Roddenberry Foundation and things that they're doing, and they really are, it really is an effort to push those ideals and ideas that have a Star Trek, you know, running theme to them about, you know, future of energy, future of food. And I really like the fact that, you know, Rod is taking this and kind of running with that whole idea.
Mm-hmm. Now, so, Clinton, yep. you being a vegan, are you vegan or vegetarian?
Technically, I'm a pescatarian, but, you know, so we'll say vegetarian.
Everything from Saru on down is all his.
that's right.
You eat fish. I was curious. Have you tried one of those meatless burgers where there's, I know there's a bunch of them out there.
Oh, I have those all the time.
Some of the newer ones. There was a newer one that's supposed to be like super awesome, but I don't know. I can't remember the name of it.
Well, I don't, there's so many out there, but,
Great endorsement, Craig.
No, I'm trying to remember the name, but there was one that just recently, I think, what's that, Bill Gates or somebody invested in? Somebody big, and it's supposed to be like, you know, just like eating a burger.
Well, see, that's the thing is that I don't, you know, we're getting off topic a bit here, so I'll try to do this really quickly, but I don't worry so much about it tasting like a hamburger, and I was not a vegetarian, you know, for many, many years. So I'm well aware of what a hamburger tastes like, because it seems kind of pointless to strive for the thing that's not the thing to taste just like the thing. It's like, why do you do that?
So you're okay as long as it tastes good is what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, as long as it's something that tastes good, it's like, and I think that if you're trying to convince somebody to try it, I don't think you want to try to convince them to try it based on the fact it tastes like a hamburger, because that's a setup for failure, because everybody's going to have their own opinion. Yeah. You want to say, try this because you might like it. Simple as that, right?
Yeah. I have a feeling that they want to emulate meat because they want to entice people to try more plant-based stuff other than that. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that is true, but.
Of course, I don't have this problem. Sorry, I'm just kidding. It was a joke.
All meat all the time. He's actually killing a cow right now. Wow.
It's podcasting.
Bizarre talking cow. That's strange. Okay, we have a last minute switch up here. So I'm going to take a story. Oh, so we got that all switched around. Very good. So my story is about Axanar.
Back to comicbook.com. Let's see what the editor sees today.
So the Star Trek popular fan film Axanar resumes production. And then repeats the exact same headline in the story. And this comes to us again from comicbook.com. So prepare. The fan project is set in the Star Trek universe and inspired by the Battle of Axanar. A battle that did not take place on screen, but was mentioned in the Star Trek, the original series episode, Whom Gods Destroy. Little is known about the battle in Star Trek canon, but it is assumed that it was a major conflict between the United Federation of Planets and the Klingon Empire, in which Captain Garth of Izar led
Lord
the Federation.
Garth!
No, this is when he was just Captain Garth.
Lord Garth!
Oh, my goodness. Axanar intended to show the Battle of Axanar in full, produced by Alec Peters and funded via Kickstarter. The project began with the release of Prelude to Axanar in 2014. The series was formatted as an in-universe documentary about the four-year war, a concept borrowed from old Star Trek tabletop RPGs. The idea was to follow up Prelude to Axanar with a feature-length film showing the actual battle, but Prelude to Axanar proved popular enough to get the attention of CBS and Paramount Pictures before the feature could be produced. In 2015, the companies filed a lawsuit against Axanar Productions over copyright issues. The lawsuit was settled in 2017. not long after CBS and Paramount released the official Star Trek fan content guidelines. As part of the settlement, Peters is not allowed to produce an Axanar feature as planned, but is allowed to make 30 minutes of new content split into two 15-minute episodes.
It's for the new YouTube generation. They can't watch anything more than a couple minutes.
Hey, what if they, did 15 minutes, but like double-timed it?
I see. Did it in 2x speed, and so then you play it back at normal speed, so it's actually an hour's worth of content total.
Yeah, because on Facebook,
audio and video.
Because on Facebook, you can change the speed down to 25%.
You can. People have uploaded stuff that way sometimes to get around such issues. The production is ongoing. I think we've documented in the past, they've moved their production facility out of Hollywood. They set up their own studio. I get updates from them because I was an initial backer of the project. They're doing a lot of building of the bridge set right now. And what's interesting is I just put out a Facebook post about how difficult is it to work with Raspberry Pis, because one of the things that they're doing is they have live video feed of all the different displays around the bridge. Mm-hmm. And they had actual desktop computers, like 14 or 16 gateway computers feeding these different monitors. And it was sucking all of the juice out of their studio. It's like they had nothing left. So they figured out, if we use Raspberry Pis, we can cut this way down. And so the latest video was showing how they were actually doing that.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Power and heat. Oh my gosh. It would, save on it big time.
And noise. I mean, fan noise of all those PCs would just mean you could not use, audio would be usable.
You just call that
the regular.
That's the warp engines. They're louder in this ship.
And you could just listen to the fans, the people that show up.
That's right. Listen to the fans. They're right inside there. That machine over there and that one over there. It didn't show anything new. And then they had a new trailer for it. That's, I think it's a new trailer. It's in this article, and you can find the article if you visit the show notes for episode 34 over at thetopicistrek.com. The interesting thing is the trailer, and I can't remember Prelude to Axanar well enough to remember if this is actually pulled from the trailer, from the short Prelude to Axanar, but it sounds to me like it's Richard Hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And he was playing the part of a Klingon.
That's right.
In that prelude. Now, obviously Richard has passed away, so he can't be, if they're doing new filming still, I don't think he can be a character unless they've already shot everything they need for his part. I don't know. So I thought that was an interesting side note about, I recognize that voice, but that's a little odd to use that voice in it. So we'll have to see when the product, it doesn't say, I'm not sure if they've announced when this thing will actually be finished. They did talk about the fact that working with the set, the way they're working with it, they're going to have like a little junction box where you can flip like three switches, turns on all the lights and powers up all the Raspberry Pis to have all the monitors. And they said, so like when the high school group comes in, they want to do something. So I think they are going to be, letting other people in to use the set, just like a lot of the other productions are doing with their bridge sets and so forth.
Sure.
So pretty interesting. People are of two minds about the whole Axanar thing that, they're the ones that brought the hammer down on fan films and all this kind of stuff. So, take that with what you will, but they are still moving ahead with their production. All right. And for our last story, I thought I would toss this one over to someone who it's somewhat local for. And I'm also going to ask him if he's experienced this experience.
Road trip. I'm calling road trip on this one. All right. From Tucson.com. Now you can boldly go where Star Trek's Captain Picard and the android Data of the USS Enterprise have gone before. Well, almost. It's not the men's room. The Titan Missile Museum in Suharita, south of Tucson, is offering a new tour of the deactivated Titan II missile facility. It is the director's tour, and it is an opportunity to view the site through the eyes of its director, Yvonne Morris. Morris has a unique perspective because she was a U.S. Air Force officer and a missile combat crew commander at the very site. From 1980 to 1984, she would work a 24-hour shift training, testing, and maintaining the peace during the Cold War. Oh, those were the good old days.
Yeah.
Were they?
But
yeah, well.
You knew who was going to attack you if they attacked you. But what may be the coolest part of the tour, especially if you're a Star Trek fan, is you have a chance to put your hand on the missile itself. Like the actors Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner in the movie Star Trek First Contact did when the Enterprise crew went back in time. Remember that? Remember that, huh?
I do.
I think you mean Picard and Data.
By the way, during the film,
missile wants to be in the Picard series as well.
All I can picture is Deanna saying, do you three want to be alone?
Yeah, right.
Let's get Donna saying that. During the filming of the 1996 movie, the missile at the Titan Missile Museum was chosen to be the stand-in for the fictitious Phoenix. Well, hey, Phoenix, Tucson, I get it now.
Yeah.
A ship used by, yes, Dr. Zefram Cochrane, known to Trek.
That Zefram Cochrane?
Yes, that Zefram. Hey, now wait a minute. As the creator of the warp drive. In the movie, the missile located in Montana, when's the last time, and the Cetacean Institute is not in Sausalito.
Yes.
We won't go there this time.
You're crushing my dreams. Yeah, stop.
That's when I realized Hollywood was a lie. It was into space, launching mankind toward an age of space exploration. Quote, Jean-Luc Picard and Data actually go into the launch duct on level 2, and they touched the missile, Morris said. We give Star Trek fans the ability to recreate that scene if they would like.
Your wife will stand up above you and say, do you want to be alone?
That's right. I'm waiting for that. The only Craig difference is you have to wear a glove.
Boo.
I'm going to bring my sparkly Michael Jackson glove. Here's what
to expect. Like a white museum glove.
No, the never one. What to expect? Quote, this is a tour given from my perspective as a former Titan II missile combat crew commander who was actually stationed at this site when it was operational, Morris said. It is a chance to look directly through a window into the Titan II program. The tour takes visitors into the launch control center through a simulated launch of the missile. During the time of the Cold War, Strategic Air Command, or SAC, had high performance standards, and as a commander at the missile site, training and testing was a constant, she said. Quote, there was so little room for error, according to Morris. How little room was there? Your knees were up by your chin. The Intercontinental missile had a 9-megaton warhead, the equivalent of 9 million tons of TNT, or three times the explosive power of all the bombs used during World War II, including both atomic bombs dropped on Japan. The missile could be launched. What were those, like 10 and 20 kilotons or something? There were something really low grade by today's standards.
The effect was still the same.
There's a sidebar that says, if you go, the 90-minute tour is located at the museum at 1580 West Duval Mine Road in Suharita, Arizona, off the Interstate 19. It is offered on the first Thursday morning of each month at 9 a.m. and is limited to 6 people who must be at least 12 years old. Proper footwear is expected, including closed-toed shoes and sturdy walking shoes with rubber soles. Flip-flops and sandals are prohibited. So there's a nice little FYI that down there that can help you get there. A Thursday at 9 a.m.? Dang, I have to get up pretty early and get there. Or we go there and stay the night. Let me think about that.
Yeah. I thought you'd like that.
The upcoming Thursday. Thank you.
Alrighty. Well,
go ahead.
Now, we covered a bunch of stories here. Were you trying to say something, Craig?
No, that was me. I was just sort of planning in my head when a convenient Thursday would be. Thursday is not exactly the easiest day of the week to get away from work, but we'll see.
I never try to interject.
I remember.
Liar!
I remember pictures or it didn't happen.
That's right.
Okay.
Alrighty. So we covered a lot of stories and we have to move on, but there are still more stories we didn't get a chance to cover. So if you go to the show notes for episode 34 over at the topic is trek.com, you can see links to not only the stories we talked about for more in-depth on them, but the stories we didn't talk about.
Or the stories we somewhat considered.
That's right. The stories that didn't cut it. No, they're fine stories, but we just don't have a lot of time.
We've been at this for 55 minutes and we're just getting to the main mission.
That's right. So our main mission, so we're coming back from subspace chatter, press a button. Going on a main mission, press a button.
Oh, man.
That's the wrong button. We're heading out of the universe.
Does this thing go any faster? Come on.
Except the restaurant at the end of the universe is back over here.
Heading out of the universe. That's really far. But anyway, so for our main mission, this time around, we'll be discussing the latest Star Trek Short Treks episode, The Brightest Star.
Yeah.
And now here's the pitch for the episode. Before he was the first Kelpian to join Starfleet, Saru lived a simple life on his home planet of Kaminar with his father and sister.
Young Kaminar's in town. Uh-oh.
Full of ingenuity and a level of curiosity uncommon among his people, yearns to find out what lies beyond his village, leading him on an unexpected path. And this short runs about 13 minutes if you take out the end credits. So it runs 15 minutes total, but 13 minutes without the credits. So I'm going to ask people, what do you think about The Brightest Star?
I didn't see any stars in there. I don't know where they came up with the title.
Good point.
He looked up in the sky and was looking at one.
You can burn his retinas out doing that.
All right, you go first, Chuck.
I liked it. I liked it because it was relatable. It was a character we've identified with and have gotten to know. And this is a great insight into his backstory. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd say of the three that we've seen so far, this is my favorite.
All righty. Very good. How about you, Craig?
I think it won up the last couple, just a little bit, gave you a little more meat on Saru's bones.
Hey, that's a lot for Doug Jones.
Yeah, it's true.
So I liked it as we alluded to a little bit before. It's just that little time frame between when he was picked up and took off. And how that fits in with his character arc that we see him today.
Second thought.
And my feeling was, the more I thought about it, the more I didn't like it, and the more I thought that this really needed to be a full episode, not a short, for it to work for me, because there were just too many shortcuts.
Good point.
What happened? You know that? Okay. They're not a technical society. We established that. He gets this thing, and with very little effort, he's able to figure out how it works.
We don't know what the time frame was. I mean, he may have been tinkering with that for a year or five.
Right. But here's the thing, and I was having this discussion with my wife, Bonnie, is that you can assume certain things, but there's nothing to indicate those things. So you don't really know how difficult it was. So to me, that was a big problem, that if it was an hour long episode, you could have that. Oh, I'm going to try this. That did nothing. I'm going to try this other thing. That does not.
Oh, that was the wrong one.
But that idea of being persistent and trying to figure it out and going through it and making it happen.
It could have used more conflict. I thought for sure his dad was going to catch him. He'd get in trouble. That never happened. You're right. So from that standpoint, that felt like it could have added more conflict and drama to the story.
Plus the fact that apparently everyone in that household is such a sound sleeper.
Yeah.
that he has to just have to walk out the front of the tent, and this thing is going beep boop beep boop beep boop.
Burlap is very sound deadening.
Nothing happens.
I think the other thing that I had a little bit of a problem with, which it seems very seemed convenient that Giorgio was the one that came and, you know, met him, which that in itself, I can kind of see, but
who did you, did you want to pick him up?
Oh, I don't know. Anybody. It didn't have to be anybody. Just be somebody Starfleet. But that
makes it more like, hey, that's cool kind of factor.
Yeah. As I'm saying, I'm okay, kind of okay with it. It just seemed a little convenient. But the other thing I thought was weird was you messed my train of thought up. Giorgio.
That's easy.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me jump in, because I have a point about that. Might be the same as yours. It might give you some time to think about your point.
Go ahead.
Here you go. Go ahead.
So I thought it was. The other convenient part about that whole with her coming down was she was able to convince Starfleet to go against, the Prime Directive to come pick up this guy.
That wasn't Prime Directive, though.
Well,
Pre-Warp Society?
Yeah. He was already interfered with, though.
Well, all right, let's back up a second here, because this is more inference and, you know, some of the issues I had with the story. Mm-hmm. The first one is, well, we don't know if Giorgio was the only one involved in this discussion about getting him, you know, picked up, because I've got a feeling a lot of people were involved with that. She probably was not the person. I mean, if she's the person that intercepted the signal, had the only conversation with, you know,
kind of like Data with that little girl on the volcanic planet.
But my bigger problem with that is that it is a pre-warp society, as far as we know, because even though the Ba'ul are capable of flight, mm-hmm. we don't know if they're capable of warp. So as far as we can tell, this is a pre-warp society, because we don't have a lot of information.
Right.
But mm-hmm. as far as we know, they're a pre-warp society. So you have a species that is intelligent, where you have one individual within that society who has indicated what could be a person who's capable of changing the direction of that society. Yeah, let's pull them right out of there so that doesn't happen.
Right.
We can't
have that.
That is like interfering on so many levels with what's going on that it's so against Starfleet. You know, pre-warp society, one thing, and second thing of all, interfering with the normal development of that culture, because, okay, you have that one person who thinks about things differently who could change that society. And you say you have to leave and you can never come back. So I had problems with that. I also had problems with, we didn't really learn anything about the predators in this thing. We also didn't learn why the Kelpians were bred to sense the coming of fear, because the coming of fear was not sensed by them when they were called.
It was the coming of death.
To the coming of death, because they didn't have that reaction going to that ceremony and being now, if that wasn't it,
you sure? I thought I saw Threat Ganglia all over when they heard the dinner bell ring.
I don't think so.
They did say that they gave themselves freely, so maybe it wasn't about.
So why were they bred to sense the coming of death when that has nothing to do with anything that we saw? So that was a question that we didn't get an answer to, and it seems to me very salient to the whole backstory of who Saru and the Kelpians are. I also thought it was odd that, oh, they're Kelpians, and look, they're picking up kelp. I said, oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
A little on the nose, wasn't it?
So, again, and I said to Bonnie, because she liked the story, I said, you know, to me, it's just the case of the more I thought about it, and I rewatched it because I was trying to come up with notes, the more it fell apart for me, that it just, it, you know, and if it had been an hour and some of those questions could have been answered.
Yeah, you could have some of that inside of Starfleet conversation, you know,
exactly. Like how did that come about? What conversation would you have to have that happen?
Mm-hmm.
So,
moral of the story, don't watch it twice.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, because to me, I felt like the Tilly story was a great B story. And I think we discussed at the time that, you know, you could insert that into some other story. Oh, and here's the B story with Tilly and the stowaway. Right. Mm-hmm. So you could do that. And I felt Calypso was so out of the ordinary that it was its own thing. It could be as long or as short as it wanted to be because it was just like its own thing. But this
needed
really
some,
was the promise of what the story was, and it just was too thin. Truncated.
It was too thin. Ah, I get it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it needed to be a little longer. For the most part, I liked it, like I said, except for some of the glaring points there towards the end where I had a problem.
Now, anybody listening to the episode might have a completely different take on what you thought about the episode. You might have some additional points about why you think it worked for you or didn't work for you, why you think this would make sense for Starfleet to take Saru off of the planet. Why the Ba'ul just kind of randomly drop things off their ship and don't even have tracking devices on them to come and get them back again. Who knows?
It would be an interesting entry point for some fanfic.
Right. So let us know if you have thoughts. You can leave a note over on our Facebook page, or you can tweet to us and let us know your thoughts about that. So we have one more short trek coming up, and that's with Harry Mudd. And that's going to be very shortly before the series.
What's the name of that one? The Escape Artist?
The Escape Artist. And that's the one that's supposed to be really off the wall. I get a feeling it's off the wall in the way that Calypso was off the wall. So I'm looking forward to that one, because I think that's another one that can be as long or as short as it wants to be, because it's just something involving Harry Mudd. And we already know a lot about Harry Mudd, so it's not like we have to have backstory. So I think it's more situational that we'll be getting out of this one. It looks to me like from the trailer that we saw that it could be how he gets off of that prison ship.
That's what I was thinking too, is how did he get off the Klingon prison ship after Lorca and
Tyler.
Thank you. I knew there was an A in his name somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't want to call him by his Klingon name, 'cause he wasn't a Klingon then.
Right.
But, you know, after they dumped him and said, see ya, he shows up with his time badge and starts jumping around. Went, okay, how did he get out of there? And he alluded to something very vaguely. But, I'll be curious to see if this is that story.
So, I think we can give our thoughts in total about this run of short treks after that one premieres, since apparently we will be getting more of them after the next season of Discovery.
I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great way to hold the fans' attention and CBS to keep people paying for all access.
Indeed. All right, so we're now going to return from our main mission. Let's see how that warp engine is doing. Since apparently it sent us out of the universe, which was really far away.
Better, into the galaxy. I think.
Come on, baby. Come on.
We got it.
Hey,
we got it.
Did you put leaded or unleaded in here?
You're breaking up. Well, we're in that void space, null space again.
Did you fill it up with leaded gas?
The leaded dilithium. Yeah.
Yeah. Let it
keeps your antimatter injectors from knocking.
It does indeed. So that doesn't explain the other sound we get. All right. Now, for a warp speed roundtable, I'm glad you're here, Chuck, because you have a deciding vote on last episode's story
first.
Oh,
you're right. I forgot. You guys had
we had a tie.
You were talking about Keenzer, Scotty's side. Now,
does Keenzer get the airlock, or does Keenzer get a shuttle pod, and why?
Okay, now remind me who voted which way.
I said that he should get the airlock.
And why?
Because he doesn't really do anything.
He sits on the cabinet until he's told to get down.
He sits on the cabinets, and his one skill is if he's, you know, that we've seen, his one skill is if he's got a cold, he can spit acid or sneeze acid. That's it.
A very weak lockpicking skill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Craig, you said he should get a shuttle pod. Why?
Quite frankly, I don't remember. You didn't listen to the episode? he's cute. He was loyal. Loyalty. What was the other? I guess. There you go. Go with that.
Yeah. There you go.
Not as compelling as I was hoping for.
Remember, his fate is in your hands, Craig.
Yeah, whatever. Oh, he looked like a cute oil.
Whatever. Life is cheap in this universe.
That's right. Yeah, there'll be another one around.
His agent can get him more work. Good luck, D-Roy.
He wants to be in the Picard series anyway, so whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, make what are you doing here? Oompa Loompa.
Yeah, he's a cute. He looked like an oyster. There you go. There's another one.
Oyster face. Yeah, he's an interesting character, but I don't see a lot of use for him either. He really didn't lend much to the story. Not even, you know, mildly comedic, but maybe if they make a fourth movie, he'll have something useful to do. I'm going to play mercy as much as I want to airlock this guy. Ooh. I'm going to play mercy and give him a shuttle pod and hope for the best.
Maybe he'll find something useful, like, there's a hole in the hull. Air is going out. Put Kienzer in it.
Kienzer patch stops everything. Yeah.
That's why he looks like duct tape. That's his skin color. Duct
his,
tape.
His face is just sticking out of this hole into space.
No, why don't you put his feet first? Oh.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So Kienzer lives to be in another movie. And John Cho is happy about that. So on to episode's Warp Speed. I think so. Warp Speed roundtable question is, in The Brightest Star, we get to learn something about Saru's life before Starfleet, his backstory, if you will. And there are a fair number of Star Trek characters who have had their past explored in some detail, but there are many who have not had the same kind of attention. And we're talking about just the film and TV, not books and so forth. So which Trek character's origin story would you like to learn?
Who's going first? Do we need to roll for this?
I'll go first.
Okay.
I'll go first. And I say Uhura. We know that she's skilled in languages, but how did that come about? Was it a natural talent? Was she a quick learner? Where did this come from? What brought her into, you know, was Starfleet the logical choice for that? What, you know, so I just don't know really anything about Uhura's backstory.
She must be pretty smart because she came back from that mind wipe pretty quickly. I mean, from one episode, she was saying Bluey to, you know, back on the bridge.
Right. And that was, so Swahili was her native language,
right?
Because that's what she defaulted to. So I think that there's a lot to learn there, and we just have never had a chance to do so. So that's whose backstory I would like to see.
That's
and again,
a good choice.
Might
that's
be explored choice. In the comics and the in books and so forth, but I'm talking about the TV and movies. Sure.
Craig. All afternoon to think about this. He told you. Yeah. You were out with your mom on her birthday. Were you not thinking about the topic of Trek?
Exactly. That's exactly what I was doing. No, I was at first. I thought, what was I had somebody in mind. It was.
All right, we'll come back to you.
I know it. I thought about Bones a little bit, McCoy, because
because
especially in the Kelvin timeline, you know, it gets a little bit more. He had a divorce, and he's going back, he's going into Starfleet.
She took everything but my bones.
Yeah, so I started thinking, I thought that might be kind of interesting, but then, to circle back around with him some, and then I thought about Scotty, and I went, maybe with Scotty, I don't know.
It's like, it was, you're not as excited about Scotty's backstory as you are about McCoy's, by the sound of it.
Well, it just sounds like McCoy has a little more color in his, you know, in the back in his backstory. So, because well, even look at what we've seen so far. We saw a little bit when he was complaining when his dad passed away in Star Trek.
Well, that's true.
In Star Trek
that's
5. True. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think there's a little bit of color there that could be explored.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's cratchety in whatever timeline you want to be in. And, you know, is that the result of something? Was he always that way? Did he sour on some stuff because of things that had happened in his past?
And why is he with the metaphors?
Yeah.
I'm a doctor, not an escalator.
And how about you, Chuck?
I went through several interesting characters. At first, the first one to come to mind was Cyrano Jones.
Okay.
I think he would have a fun history to explore. You could, you know, just a crafty, clever character. Then I started thinking about the Crusher family pre-TNG. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, there's Wesley was young.
With Daddy.
Jack died. You know, that whole thing. What happened? Let's explore the accident, you know, that kind of thing. But then I landed on Boothby from Starfleet Academy. He has almost this mythical story around him. You hear a little bit about him, how he advised Picard when he was young, and how Picard said, you know, seek him out to Wesley. We did get to see a glimpse of him, and I'm not quite sure how he went from how he got to be a Starfleet groundskeeper from being a teacher at Ridgemont High. But you know, we'll figure that out somewhere in between the timeline.
You're crossing the stream.
But I thought he would be an interesting character to explore, just from that. You know what? Why? What makes him so wise? And you know, how did he get where he is, and what did Picard actually get from him?
Right. And, you know, and is he street smarts? Did he have a career that kind of had him traveling places? You know, what,
or was he blacklisted? You know, what happened? You know, there's
this, right.
Hey, he even talked to, Janeway.
Yep.
And, again, this is not film or TV, but in Star Trek Online, apparently, though you don't see it, I didn't come across it, that he's a holographic character still at Starfleet after he's dead. So, I mean, that's kind of
immortalized. They don't build statues anymore. Let's just make him hologram.
Was he like that dead Jedi glowy thing?
Yeah, kind of like that, except he had a trowel. You know, it's weird. So I think those are three good choices. That these are characters that we talk about, we've seen, but we don't really know an awful lot about their background. And if you consider McCoy from the Prime timeline, really the only glimpse of the background I think we get is, as you said, Craig, that bit from Star Trek V. That, we really don't know anything about his background, except he grew up in Georgia.
Yeah, he keeps coming out with this Southern accent from time to time.
Yeah.
Hey, the other one I thought about was, another main character was Worf, you know, cause he's been pushing for the Worf Chronicles, and I'm thinking, well, there's some backstory, and you know, a little bit about that, where he went to Earth. You could see, you could explore
the Rojenkos, the Battle of Kittimer, the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed.
You know, actually, Worf turned out to be one of my favorite characters, because especially after Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. He's kind of the Frasier of Star Trek, isn't he? Kind of crosses over from one series to another. And
he was in the bar on 10-4, and then he's all of a sudden over here, and you got his own show. Yeah.
It's amazing. Michael Dorn did a great job with that character.
Absolutely.
Yeah, especially, like I said, I liked him on TNG. But when he crossed over to Deep Space Nine, it took him to another level, and I liked him even more.
So did Cole Meany.
Well, that's true. He didn't have much dynamics on TNG. Oh, he did it towards the end, but when he was on Deep Space Nine, he really he got his time too. So yeah, I liked him on TNG.
He's captured perfectly in that comic. What is it? O'Brien at work.
Yeah. We're sitting there,
standing there,
console,
waiting for a message to come in. But yeah, they gave him some depth and a family.
Yeah, I think he worked out well. He was a war, like a POW. You know, he was lots of things in Deep Space Nine.
Oh, that's right. He was. The Cardassians had him for a while, mm-hmm. didn't they?
They did.
He had a real problem getting over that when they first appeared on the scene.
Keiko came over from TNG as well.
Oh, that yep.
Yeah. Wow. Really?
I changed my vote. I want to follow her backstory. Let's see what's up with her.
Why don't we have Molly's backstory? We pretty much know Molly's backstory.
Well, there was a big backstory. Well, yeah. Well, it wasn't exactly.
The backstory, her alternate history backstory, yeah, which we got, but we also got her regular backstory because we saw her being born and growing up. So it's like, well, there's not much to tell there, but.
Hey, I tell you who else. Okay, I know we got to move on, but I tell you who I'd like to see future information about. And that would be, oh my God, I am
Jake
terrible with names today.
Well, yeah. I've had those days, so take your time.
I'm sitting here trying to remember names. I cannot remember names to save my life. Quark's nephew.
Nog.
Nog, oh my God.
That's what
you.
I said, Jake or Nog. One Nog. Of those two.
I was like, well, we saw Jake a little bit, you know, in the future, but I'd like to see a Nog story. I think you can see some in comic books, if I'm not mistaken, but, you know, he ends up being a captain. And actually... He was a rags to riches story that I really liked, ended up liking on Deep Space Nine, because he went from being annoying to really a decent Starfleet, you know, officer.
In less than 8 years.
Yeah. He had a leg up on the... Oh, sorry. Never mind.
He had a leg up on Saru.
Shouldn't have. Shouldn't be bad phrase to use there. Sorry. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh. I got it.
There you go. All right. On that bad pun, if you have any ideas of who you would like to have more backstory on, not like we can fulfill on it, although we can, I'm sure all the people in Hollywood who listen to Topic is Trek will be fascinated to hear about this.
I want Clinton's backstory.
There we go. It's started at 5,000 watt radio station. Anyway. You can leave a note over on our Facebook page for The Topic is Trek, or send us a tweet at The Topic is Trek. All right, gentlemen, I think it's time to refill the dilithium chamber with that leaded dilithium and get on out of here.
I think so.
Once again, I'm Clinton, and you can find me at comedyforecast.com. You can find me on Facebook at Comedy Forecast. You can find me on Twitter, Comedy Forecast, blah, 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 Comedy Forecast, all the way, all one word with the number 4. And Chuck and Craig, you're still doing Technorama.
Still. We are, I think yesterday was the 14th anniversary of me releasing my first podcast ever. So, yeah.
Excellent. And what episode number are you up to for Technorama these days?
6,212.
No, it's just not what it feels like, what number it actually is.
553.
There you go. Unless
you go by my typo, it was 533.
Well, you can be writing for comicbook.com any day now. Anyway.
Kelvin timeline.
Yeah.
So it's time to hit the theme, boys. If you like the show, please be sure to tell a friend about it and subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you, so follow us on Twitter at The Topic is Trek, visit our Facebook page, or visit thetopicistrek.com. Until next time, on behalf of Chuck, Craig, and myself, I'm Clinton, thanking you for listening. And as we always say here on The Topic is Trek, Don't cook bacon without a red shirt on. I know that's. I try so hard. I really do. I just don't know.